Old Models is the kind of work typically associated with William Harnett. It features an eclectic assortment of musical and literary objects set upon a wooden cupboard door. A descriptive catalog of them might read, dented trombone, tarnished violin and bow, quaint Dutch jug, three aged leather-bound books, a small pamphlet, which is nestled behind the upright book there, and a tattered compendium of sheet music from which a soul leaf has strayed. They're all rather quotidian objects, but they have been rendered with the same care and precision that prompted one reviewer to exclaim, in reference to another work by the artist, quote, "The wood is wood, the iron is iron, the brass is brass, the leather is leather," end quote. Harnett is known for the variety and the veracity of the objects in his paintings that have persistently, if dubiously, been designated trompe l'oeil. His work has thus been situated in relation to various mechanical innovations at the time, like industrial modes of production and photography, even as its subjects have been understood as a nostalgic throwback to simpler times. Either way, the human body appears to play no role in his work, either in its content or in its factor. But this elision of the body and Harnett's focus on ordinary objects should make us take pause, given that for over 10 years, the artist studied at multiple art academies on the East Coast. Slide, please. From 1866 to 1875, he was alternately enrolled at the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art and the National Academy of Design, both in New York. It was at the National Academy that he produced this work, Borghese Warrior, which will anchor my talk today. The drawing was completed in 1873, possibly to gain entrance to the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where it currently resides, and where Harnett would study for several more years. There, as at the Cooper Union and the National Academy, he attended antique classes and life classes, where he learned to draw from plaster casts and the live model. But why would this artist, who has come to be associated with pristine paintings of inanimate objects, study how to draw the human figure for over 10 years? Or, to take a less retrospective view, why would Harnett turn to still life and trompe l'oeil after over a decade of academic study? In this talk, I will explore how the culture of anatomy, in particular the images and objects associated with its study, would have shaped how Harnett understood the body, the primary vehicle of academic art. I will argue that Borghese Warrior both pictures and deploys the body as a mechanical apparatus. The cast and the drawing in which it appears were both products of this tool. At the Academy, then, Harnett came to understand man-made things as the most complete and accurate representation of man himself. He would thus absorb the Academy's most fundamental precepts, only to redefine the media through which they were realized. Slide. Borghese Warrior is first and foremost a picture of a male nude. The figure is engaged in hand-to-hand combat, likely with a mounted opponent. But as his left arm reaches up to strike and his left leg extends back to lend it strength, his body lacks the tension and vigor one would expect from such an action. Instead, it looks disjointed and somewhat apathetic, or perhaps unmotivated. Cast in shadow, his left arm is a solid, if not stolid, mass. Further, Harnett's attempt at foreshortening has resulted in an unnaturally truncated bicep and compressed forearm that hardly seems suited to their task. The armpit has also been gradated into an unnuanced passage that glosses over the actual mechanics of how the arm is attached to the body. But the figure's torso exhibits a surplus of detail. It is turned towards us to reveal his left pectoral and abdomen, whereas his gesture would seem to require a profile view. Slide. As seen in this similar cast currently in use in the Antiquities Hall at Paffa, which I tried to photograph from the same angle. As the warrior jolts to the left, his body extends into a sleek diagonal that places his chest into profile. His leg provides the support that his upper body needs to torque and thus unleash his strength. In Harnett's drawing, though, the chest sits unceremoniously atop the man's legs. His left thigh is affixed to, rather than interlocked with, the lower abdomen, and his right thigh distends from his groin. The legs, then, do not feed the action of the upper body. They merely support it, if that. The warrior looks as though he has been taken apart and then reassembled from multiple different perspectives to create a complete, if not entirely unified, whole. These inconsistencies surely reflect Harnett's inexperience with drawing, and drawing the human body in particular, at this early moment in his career. But the way in which he tackled this problem also reveals something about how the body was understood at this time. Slide. The most popular textbook on this subject when Harnett was at the Academy was Anatomy, Descriptive and Surgical, now known as Gray's Anatomy, after its author, Henry Gray. The book is divided into approximately 250 sections, like the one I've highlighted here on the muscles in the abdomen, which covers six muscles, primarily the obliquus externus and the obliquus internus, as well as the transversalis, rectus, pyramidalis, and quadratus lumborum, and includes five illustrations around which the discussion revolves. Slide. First, Gray describes how to incise the flesh in order to access the muscles. Next, he explains the location and appearance of the external oblique, which, quote, so called from the direction of its fibers, is situated on the lateral and anterior aspects of the abdomen, being the largest and the most superficial of the three flat muscles in this region. It is broad, thin, irregularly quadrilateral in form, its muscular portion occupying the sides, its aponeurosis, the anterior wall of that cavity, end quote, and so on. Gray then describes its relations, or how the external oblique is connected to its neighbors. Quote, by its external surface with the superficial fascia, superficial epigastric and circumflexa illi vessels, and some cutaneous nerves. By its internal surface with the internal oblique, the lower part of the eight inferior ribs and intercostal muscles, the cremaster, the spermatic cord in the male, and the round ligament in the female, end quote, etc. But we don't see any of that in the illustration, which for all intents and purposes simply indicates the precise location of the muscle in the torso. Slide. Gray then proceeds to give the internal oblique on the left there the same treatment before he moves on to the smaller muscles in the region on the right. The illustrations isolate and locate the layers of muscles beneath the external oblique. But the text does not indicate how any of these muscles function, either individually or in concert. It simply, albeit meticulously and methodically, dissects and describes them as a series of interlocked parts. Slide. Likewise, Harnett doesn't sketch the contours and outline of the body as a whole. He sutures the form together from individually observed areas. It is as though the head, arms, legs, and torso were drawn separately and then reassembled on the page. The body, then, is not presented as an organic being, but as a physical, even mechanical, thing. But if the cast isn't depicted as a living, breathing creature, it also isn't portrayed as a work of art. To be sure, it appears on a stone slab accompanied, if not inordinately melded to, the large vase or urn that would support the sculpture's weight in reality. But the figure has been evacuated of any emotional or intellectual depth. Slide. In this slightly later drawing, which is in the exhibition next door, Daniel Gruber attempts to represent the anguish in his model, Michelangelo's dying slave. He depicts the contours of the body with languid lines that carve the cast from the ivory-laid paper, as Michelangelo excised it from the stone. The drawing thus distills the cause and affect of the pose into sensuous curves and swelling passages. This kind of passion, or even force, is not to be found in Harnett's drawing of the Borghese warrior. The surprise, fear, and focus seen in the model are absent from the vacant eyes, chiseled nose, and closed lips of the drawing. Further, Harnett exaggerates the calf muscles in the left leg and the cavernous, if somewhat disproportionate and misplaced, cavity above the left pectoral. He renders the anatomy, rather than the psyche, visible and legible on the body. Slide. Thomas Aikens created plaster casts of corpses expressly for this purpose. He made at least 18 of them, several animal limbs and multiple human appendages, a number of which, like this frontal male torso, can be seen in Anatomy Academy. They were made as visual aids to the anatomy lectures offered by Dr. William Williams Keene at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. And Keene, we might note, edited both the 1887 and 1893 American editions of Gray's Anatomy. The torso is meant to display and illustrate the muscles and fasciae of the trunk, as Henry Gray referred to the region between the upper arms and thighs in his tract. But the object looks less like the fleshy insides we might expect to see and more like a hard exterior shell. In fact, were it not for the fibrous ligaments around the groin, we might take this for a cast of the exterior of the body. It appears remarkably intact, save for several excisions on its right-hand side. A sizable rectangular chunk has been cut out just below the rib cage, and yet another below and somewhat beside it. These incisions correspond to directions given by Henry Gray in the section on the muscles of the abdomen that I discussed earlier. They reveal the layers of muscles that constitute the flesh, which Aikens cast without any tweaking or remodeling. He then color-coded and labeled the cast, using red for the muscles and yellow ochre for the tendons and fasciae, as well as the Latin names inscribed upon them. The cast thus presented the human body as an object, and more so as a legible surface. Slide. Harnett treats the plaster cast in Borghese Warrior in a similar way. Even if the warrior's body is not entirely physiologically accurate, it exhibits the veins, muscles, and bones that comprise it. Harnett then casts the body as an object, albeit one taken from a sculpture rather than an actual corpse. It thus represented the hands that made it, those of Agesias of Ephesus around 100 BCE, as well as his copyists, rather than the layers of flesh of which the warrior was comprised. Slide. This is perhaps why an object like the cast sculpture of a Greek contrapposto figure would need to be supplemented by a skeleton, anatomical cast, corpse, and live model in an anatomy lecture, like the one being given by Dr. Keene in this drawing by Charles Stevens for Harper's Weekly. It takes its place as just one of many visual aids, the rest of which provide much more direct access to the body. Slide. But Harnett makes the cast the sole, ostensible subject of his work. It extends diagonally from the upper left hand to the lower right hand corner of an oversized page that has been shaded from edge to edge. The deep and oddly geometric shadow that it casts upon the background identifies this material expanse as a wall. Thus, were it not for the slab base on which the cast rests, this could even be the drawing of a relief sculpture. Slide. Which is quite possibly the subject of another study by Harnett, A Sprig of Plums, at the National Gallery. Even so, the figure mobilizes and activates the page as it diagonally bisects it from the upper left to the lower right-hand corner. It highlights the physical boundaries and sheer expanse of the paper, which measures approximately 3 feet by 3 feet, quite possibly the size of the actual cast on which it was based. The sheet of paper then was rendered as palpable, as material, as the object sketched upon it. Drawing was the most fundamental skill taught at the National Academy of Design, as well as the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts at this time. But what did it mean to draw? Slide. Thomas Aikens would write, if not publish, a manual on the subject, and Rembrandt Peale's Graphics, a manual of drawing and writing for the use of schools and families, on the screen here, was in at least its third reprint at this time. Peale's book is divided into two sections, one on each practice, and progresses through a series of exercises, namely different subjects to draw, from straight lines to diagonal lines, regular and irregular triangles, and various kinds of curves. Curves within angles and outside of angles, irregular curves, and curves defined by angles. The student was thus to hone both his eye and his hand and learn to bring them into alignment. For example, in the section on the proportions of lines, Peale writes, quote, Efforts cannot be too often made to fix the rule and compass in the eye, which can be accomplished only by frequent observation and practice," end quote. Drawing, then, was a way to train the eye to assess measurements, scale, and distances accurately. And in the section on practice of curves, he notes that, quote, "This should be practiced until the lines, though frequently repeated, shall be but little or irregularly widened, nothing more being intended than to habituate the hand to every motion and an instantaneous obedience to the will," end quote. It was thus also a way to discipline the hand. Drawing thereby prepared one for the demands of writing. It enabled the student to judge and assess the lines and actions required to copy and execute particular letters. It was thus less a type of mark-making than it was a way to exercise and train the body. Harnett had some experience with drawing outside of his studies at the academy, but it was of a very different sort. Slide. From 1865 through 1875, he worked as a silver engraver in both New York and Philadelphia, an occupation that sustained both his studies and his family throughout this time. It was then that he is presumed to have made the designs contained within this unpublished sketchbook that I recently uncovered at the Archives of American Art. The book contains 15 sheets covered to differing degrees with ornamental motifs that cannot be clearly identified or labeled. They are, like the designs on the screen, largely symmetrical arrangements of geometric and floral forms that could be easily incised onto tableware or flatware. The various degrees of finish these designs exhibit suggest how Harnett may have devised them. It appears he would start with a light vertical line, as can be seen most clearly in the upper left-hand corner, but also hidden beneath the unfinished motif in the lower left. And he would then, quite free-handedly and seemingly spontaneously, construct a loose, simple, and linear armature around it. It might then be embellished with free-floating dots, dashes, and lines, shaded at certain points, or expanded according to pattern. Harnett would underscore the contours of some of these designs and abandon others, but they all emerged purely from his imagination. They were fantastic, if not quite whimsical, sprung from his unconscious and onto the page. Slide. Borghese Warrior, however, was based on a real object in the real world. Harnett had to observe the cast, decipher the body, and translate or transcribe it onto the page. In contrast to his professional practice, this was a technical challenge, one which he met with great creativity, if not quite accuracy. Harnett positioned the cast according to the physical parameters of the page, which thus dictated the composition of the drawing. He treated it like the objects, the silverware and flatware, for which he had sketched his fantastical designs. It was a surface that he rendered physical, visible, and thus intelligible, like the very cast within it. Only the body that the drawing makes legible is not simply the one in the picture, but the one behind it. Harnett worked and molded charcoal and chalk all over the entire surface of this pink-laid paper to depict and position the cast. He harnessed his own body, his eyes and his hand, if not his chest and legs, to realize the image on this grossly oversized page. The drawing was thus a record of the observations and actions used to make it, inscribed in the disjointed body and solid wall of which it was comprised. It was the physical product of this visual and manual exercise. At the Academy, then, Harnett came to understand the body as a tool, not simply a subject of art. Slide. As we know, the body would actually almost entirely disappear from Harnett's work. He would take up used instruments, musical scores, aged books, and bric-a-brac like those we see in old models. Man-made things that he would render with the care and precision the Academy normally reserved for human beings. But if drawing from casts transformed how Harnett thought about the body as a medium, anatomical thought transformed how he saw it as a subject. It cast the body as a purely physical thing that didn't reflect the psyche, the self, or the intellect so much as the biology that constituted it. Harnett thus came to understand the physical body as an insufficient representation of man, particularly since advances in the social and cognitive sciences at this time, like anthropology and psychology, were also revealing the complexity of human subjectivity and exploring how it could be depicted. His studies at the Academy brought this issue to a head as he came to see and depict the body as an object, a product of the human hand. Harnett would spend the rest of his career experimenting with subjects and techniques that would enable him to adapt this mode of representation to painting. In his last works, like Old Models, Multi-Object Trompe-l'Oeil Still Lifes, man was thus nowhere as present as in the quotidian objects that populate the canvas and the meticulous brushstrokes used to render them. Thank you.